Good afternoon. So, last time we talked about reader-writer locks. We mentioned that there's a common pattern, kind of like the barrier pattern, in that it's something that comes up in a lot of programs that could deserve a specialized tool. And this is where we have some data structure, which it's safe to read from multiple threads at the same time, but if one thread's modifying it, we better have no other thread looking at it, because they'll get sort of inconsistent answers. Common reasons would be like, if it's like a binary tree, we might be changing where pointers go, and that could cause us to go to memory that's deallocated if we aren't doing this sort of taking turns where either we're reading it only or we're modifying it. Synchronization tool we have for this is something called reader-writer locks. So the interface reader-writer locks provide is that, like locks, we have a lock and an unlock operation, but we have two kinds. We have write locks, which are exclusive. When you get a write lock, no one else gets to use the lock. So anyone else locking for reading or writing waits until you're done. And we have read locks, which, unlike our normal locks, as many people as threads as we want can have a read lock at the same time. They can all read at once, but anyone having a read lock prevents a thread from getting a write lock. So one way of thinking about it is the readers can all share the read lock, but writers cannot share a write lock. And we looked at this as an example of something we could do with monitors. So monitors are one way we could implement this. Of course, we could implement it with semaphores, or in the same sort of way we saw mutexes being implemented. And the latter is probably what is done for performance by, say, the typical implementations of the POSIX reader-writer locks. But we saw when we implemented this, we had this interesting decision about, well, if we have both readers and writers waiting to go, who gets priority? And we saw that we had this kind of risk that, well, if we just always let readers go, then if we have a bunch of readers, writers will never get a chance. Just readers will just be overlapping with each other. There'll be no time when there's no readers. And we saw this sort of common pattern which comes up when using monitors, that when you wanted to make a decision about favoring one or the other, the big thing we did is we tracked who was waiting, and we used that as part of our logic around condition variables, about whether we waited or signaled, was based on that information about who was waiting. We saw that this allowed us to implement different sorts of policies. We could prefer readers. We could say, no, writers should need to wait, and they really should need to wait. We don't want one writer, then the next writer, then the next writer to keep going and allow no one to read, for example. We can make that decision. We also talked about deadlock. So deadlock, we mentioned, was this problem where we had threads that just couldn't make progress. And they couldn't make progress in a way which was unlike things we've seen before, where threads weren't making progress, and that we couldn't solve it by like taking turns. And it was because we had one thread effectively waiting on itself. That the thread was waiting to acquire some resource, and it turned out that that resource was held by another thread, which somehow was waiting for the first thread to release some resource it was holding. And we mentioned, if we think about deadlock, we have these four conditions for deadlock. We have this mutual exclusion condition. We have this hold and wait condition. So the mutual exclusion is that, we don't have deadlock if you don't have resources that we can't share between any number of threads. That we have to have sort of choose which thread gets it. If we don't have that problem, we don't have a problem. So we have unlimited resources, no problem. We have this hold and wait condition. We don't have deadlock if we don't have threads holding a resource that another thread might want. If a thread's holding a resource another thread might want, then there's an opportunity for us to be stalled waiting for that resource to be released. We don't have deadlock, hold and wait. A important part of that is we hold a resource And we also try to acquire other resources, right? That's a big part of deadlock. It's not only are we holding a resource another thread might want, but we're also acquiring other resources while we do that. So we can avoid it by, you know, also by, say, acquiring all the resources at once. That avoids that this hold and wait problem, because yes, we're holding, but we're not waiting for some other resource while we're holding. Also, preemption of resources we need to not have. And by preemption, I mean we need to have no way of taking away a resource from a thread without the thread having a say in it. So we saw with like compute time, our typical schedulers preempt a process, meaning that they take away their use of the processor, even though they don't have a say in that. And if we have resources which all act like that, so for example, we somehow made our locks such that we could say, oh, sorry, we're going to take away your lock on the map somehow, then we wouldn't have a deadlock with that map. That's typically not practical for things like locks. It's practical for the CPU because we do have a way of doing that, taking away the resource temporarily to resolve conflicts. But for things like, what we use locks for, that's often very tricky to do because we'd have to do a bunch of work to get the shared resource into a safe state. State that made sense and didn't make our program behave incorrectly. And our last condition is that we need to have circular wait. So circular wait means that we need to have a thread that's waiting on another thread, that's waiting on another thread, that's waiting on the first thread. We need to have that cycle. And the circular wait condition gives us usually the most practical way of avoiding deadlock, especially with locks, and that's to have a consistent ordering. Because having this cycle means we had an inconsistent ordering, that in order to have sort of that last edge back to the first thread of the cycle, we must have, you know, held resource B while acquiring A, rather than going in the sort of A to B to C direction, or something like that, B while acquiring A, or C while acquiring A, and so on. But if we have a consistent order, if we think of drawing that sort of graph representation, you know, where we said we had thread waiting on a resource, which a thread had waiting on a resource, then sort of all the arrows going out from a thread to acquire a resource are all going sort of in one direction. So we can't have that cycle. And this strategy is the most common by far and the most practical for avoiding deadlocks. There's also other strategies we can use, which are used. Notably, I mentioned that databases do this thing where they just say, we're going to have deadlock happen, and then we're going to detect that that scenario exists and revoke locks to undo it. But that's not something that's practical for general purpose programs to arrange. So questions about reader-writer locks or deadlock? Yes? Sorry, are all these locks?
How are these locks implemented? Like, is one lock implemented using another?
So the question is, like, for reader-writer locks, are they implemented using, like, other types of locks?
Yeah.
So they could be. We saw an example of how they could be. And it's going to depend on what system you're on, whether that's true. I would guess that it's most common for all the types of locks in a typical threading library to be implemented using the kinds of strategies we saw with that mutex implementation in terms of spin locks, things in that neighborhood, because that's most efficient, versus, it's a little less efficient to implement it on top of monitors because you just sort of have extra layers of indirection. Other questions? Okay. So, we talked about deadlock. Right. Bunch. Mentioned, so we have our conditions, since we have these sort of ways of avoiding deadlock, infinite resources, no shared resources, just not waiting, so just giving up, like we saw, like malloc doesn't have a deadlock problem because, well, we can't malloc something, we just give up. We could do that for locks, but it is tricky to think, what do you do if you can't get a lock? Besides give up. We could revoke locks that programs have, we could try to interrupt the operation and have them redo it later. That's what databases do. But most commonly, we just acquire resources in a consistent order. And remember, any ordering will do. You just have to choose one. You just have to make sure you always use it. And that avoids a deadlock. And commonly in sort of real code, this is just done by someone writing down, this is the order we acquire locks in this code. And make sure you do it in that order and not some other order. Like in these examples of comments from the Linux kernel. Okay, so that's about deadlock. And our next topic is going to be about virtual memory. And virtual memory is a little odd for prereqs in this class. So if you've taken CS3330, or you've taken the Pilot Computer Organization and Architecture course, virtual memory is covered for several days. If you're a computer engineering student, you probably took, as a prereq for this class, the ECE Embedded class. You might have also taken the Computer Engineering Architecture class, which is not a prereq for this class, which is a 4,000 level ECE course. And there's a lot less virtual memory coverage in those two ECE courses. And this is an unfortunate disconnect, which means that some of you computer engineering students are probably going to be a little more confused than our computer architecture and COA2 students. Though I have found in general that it seems like my CS3330 students and COA2 students remember a lot less than I expect about virtual memory, so we're going to be doing some review. Anyways, but just mentioning that there's some uneven backgrounds here, which is unfortunate. This is something that will change with the new curriculum, happily. Which means you've seen different amounts of material, so especially if you're a computer engineering student, or, you know, please don't be surprised if you need to ask me questions to get me to slow down. And since there's three different versions of the material, you know, it's not uncommon for you to know different things than the person next to you. Okay, so virtual memory is the mechanism by which address translation actually works in pretty much every system you've used. There's other ways of doing address translation. We're not going to talk about them. And by address translation, I mean when we're writing a program, its addresses go through this mapping set by the operating system from the program's addresses, which we'll call virtual addresses, to the real addresses, which we will call physical addresses. And the operating system determines what this mapping is and can set a different mapping for each program. And this allows us to give the illusion that each program has its own memory, because as far as each program is concerned, address, say, 1000 is whatever the OS defines it to be. And it's a completely different part of memory for each program if the OS wants to make things that way. So the typical scheme used to implement this is we're going to divide up our program's memory, these are its virtual addresses, into fixed size units we're going to call pages. And I'm going to use this toy example where we have a 10-bit address. And why 10 bits? So it fits on my slides comfortably. Not because that's a realistic size. So I'm going to divide this up into fixed size pages, and in this case I've chosen that each page is 256 bytes, and I've numbered them starting with 0. So 0, 1, 2, and 3, and I've decided that I'm going to put different things in each page. So I've decided I'm going to put the code of the program in page 0, it's data like global variables and heap in page 1, it's stack in page 3, and have page 2 available for more heap if it allocates enough. And each of these pages has a range of addresses we can see here. And I chose the size of 256 bytes, or 2 to the 8 bytes, and that's not a coincidence. I've deliberately chosen a size that's a power of 2, because that's going to make everything much more convenient. And we'll see that every real process you're going to see is going to choose a size that's a power of 2, because it's going to make things more convenient. And the way it's going to make things more convenient is because I chose that power of 2 size, if I look at the upper bits of the virtual address, that corresponds to my virtual page number. So all the addresses up to 100 have 00 in their two upper bits and are in virtual page 0. All the addresses from 100 up to 200 have 01 in their upper two bits, and they're in virtual page 1, and so on. So this means that figuring out what virtual page an address is in is really fast. I just subset the bits of the address. And if we chose a virtual page size that was not a power of 2, it would not be really fast. So we're not going to do that. So this is representing the addresses the program can see, but we need to map them somehow to real addresses. So we'll see that. And the way we're going to do the mapping is we're going to keep the virtual pages together. So we're going to have to deal with the rest of the address, which we're going to call the page offset. And the way we're going to do the mapping is we're going to map this virtual page here to a same size chunk of physical memory. So the offset in that chunk is going to stay the same when we do the map. So what does this look like? So here I have my virtual addresses. And let's say I have more physical addresses than virtual addresses. Just for this example, in real systems, it could go either way. We could have more or less, or the same. And just like I divided my virtual addresses, the addresses the program can see, into these fixed size pages, I'm going to divide up the physical addresses in the exact same way. So I'm going to have the same size of what I call physical pages, and for the same reason, we could use the upper bits of the virtual address to get the virtual page number. I can use the upper bits of the physical address to get the physical page number. And the way I'm going to construct my mapping is I'm always going to map a virtual page to a physical page. So I'm never going to decide to have, map a virtual page to like half of one physical page and half of another. It's always going to map to a whole physical page, starting at the beginning of that physical page, going all the way to the end. So for example, I might do this mapping here, where I've decided that virtual page 0 goes to physical page 2, virtual page 1 goes to physical page 7, and virtual page 3 goes to physical page 0. And virtual page 2 apparently goes to nothing. And what I've said here, for example, is this means that address 0 goes at the beginning of physical page 2. Address 10 is 10 bytes into physical page 2. The whole page maps one, each byte corresponds to each byte from the virtual page to the physical page. So I have this sort of mapping I've drawn out pictorially. We can't actually draw a picture for a processor, so we're going to represent this as a table. So I have a table where I have a row for each virtual page number, and I indicate what the physical page number is. And we call this the page table. And this is more like the information I'm going to give to the processor. This is something kind of figure out how to express to the processor. And that's what the mapping is that we're going to set. Some questions so far? Yes?
So for this particular example, are they supposed to be corresponding to each other?
Is there a reason that?
No, so for this example, is the thing in the red box and the rest of the example supposed to be corresponding to the end?
So this thing in the red box corresponds to the rest of the example? Yes. So I said that virtual page 0 mapped to physical page 2. That's indicated by this row of the table. Said that virtual page 1 maps to physical page 7. That's indicated by this row of the table, and so on. Other questions? Yes?
At least for the time being, the mapping is arbitrary, right? It's just an example.
So the mapping is arbitrary? Yes, so for the time being, the mapping is arbitrary, and in general, the mapping is whatever the OS sets it to. So the OS can make whatever choice it wants here, and the processor is just going to implement that choice, and hopefully that choice does what the OS was intending to do. So let's think of how this lookup works. So typically, if we represent a page table, one way we might do it is, well, one thing we need is we have that none entry, right? We actually need a way of indicating there's something here or there's not. So we'll use an extra bit for that. We'll call a valid bit. So here's a representation of this table where we have valid bits. So we can indicate that we have virtual page 2, which doesn't map to anything. And the processor is going to have this table. And it's going to take the address from the program. It's going to convert it to the virtual page number and page offset. It's going to look up the virtual page number to get an entry from this table. It's going to see if it's valid. If it's not valid, it's going to trigger an exception. An exception we will call a page fault. And if it's valid, it's going to use the physical page number to form the actual address that it's going to pass on to the memory system. And it's going to combine that with the page offset, which is going to be copied unchanged. So in this process, we call the thing we look up in the page table a page table entry. We call the page number part of the virtual address the virtual page number, the page number part of the physical address the physical page number, and the rest of the address for physical or virtual, the page offset. Questions? Just look up, yes.
So how do you determine that zero stack to this code set of data? Like, where do you draw the line for
you? So how do I determine that zero, one, that this is code two, so how do I determine for this entry?
So how do you determine that two represents code?
So how do I determine that two represents code? So the processor wouldn't know that. That's just indicating how this corresponds to our previous example. Other questions? Okay, so let's little example. So in XV6, it's built for 32-bit XV6, and the way it uses virtual memory, we're gonna have deal with 2^12 or 4096 byte pages. So as a first exercise, let's say we have this virtual address. I want you to know what's the virtual page number part of that address and what's the page offset part of that address. I'll give you some time, and then if we looked it up in the virtual page number up in the table and found physical page 998, what would the physical address we'd send to the memory system be? And as a hint or reminder, if we have this in hex, this corresponds to, we can just expand each hex, rate it to 4 bits each, which is very helpful in doing this sort of thing. Which means that, for example, you know, one hex digit represents 4 bits. We're thinking of how if we want to split up this into certain sets of bits. Okay, who'd like some more time? Okay, can someone tell me what's the virtual page number? Yeah.
ABCD0.
Okay, so you had ABCD0, and how did you get that?
So we have 32-bit address, I mean 32-bit, so that's 2 to the 32 amount of data.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to divide that by 2 to the 12, which is the size of a single page.
Okay.
So which is 2 to the 20, and 20 bits is 5 nibbles.
Okay, so you said, oh, okay, so if we think of how we're dividing up, so you said that we have 2 to the 32 divided by 2 to the 12 pages, which means 2 to the 20 pages, which means page numbers are 20 bits. So that's fine. I think there's a little something to be careful about when just taking, saying, okay, we have 2 to the 20 pages, this means we need 20-bit page numbers. And this is true, but you need to be careful because if I give you the address 1234, that's still an address on a 32-bit system. I just didn't write the leading zeros. So you have to be careful doing that. So the way I would figure this out is I would probably work from saying we have our address, which is 32 bits. And I know I need a page offset. A page offset, remember, is where on the page we are. And since our pages are 2 to the 12 bytes, we have 2 to the 12 possible locations. So I would say that means we need 12 bits to get the page offset. And the rest is going to be our page number. So I would think of it as, okay, we're going to remove the last 12 bits. How much is 12 bits of this hex thing? Well, each hex rated is 4 bits. So 12 bits is going to be these 12 bits, which is going to be our page offset. And everything else after I remove the page offset is the virtual page number. So questions on either way of figuring this out? Yeah. What? So I said 20 bits is the size of the page number. Yeah, so 20 bits is the size of a page number, but be careful because, you know, we often don't write all our leading zeros on addresses. So for example, 0x1234, that's an address, and that's a real address we could have in a 32-bit system. I just didn't write it as with all the leading zeros to save space, right? But indeed, if that's an address where the virtual page number, if it was a virtual address, would be 1. Does that answer your question? Okay, so how about, what's the physical address? Okay, 0x00998123, and how did you get that?
So the physical page is 998, and then you would take the offset from the virtual page address, which is 123, but that's only 6 bits, so you need 2 extra bits.
That's only 6, 12 bits?
Or 6 bytes.
6 bytes, 6 hexadecimal digits, okay,
yeah.
Okay. Okay, so I guess I would say, yeah, you're correct that we're just copying the page offset, and then we're adding the page number, which is what we saw here. And you said, oh, I want to make it a 32-bit value. We didn't actually tell you what the size of physical addresses are. And I would just write it without the leading zeros, especially since I don't know that. It's the same. Okay, so questions about this exercise? Okay, so we know how addresses are split up, and if our page table worked the way we thought, well, you know, we'd say, okay, we're going to divide up our address into a page number and a page offset. We're going to copy the page offset, look up the page number in this table, and it's going to turn out that our page table entries, we're going to find out, are going to have not only the valid bit and the physical page number, they're going to have a little extra metadata about like whether it's okay to read or write or access things in kernel mode are also going to be in the page table. that the processor is going to use to possibly trigger an exception. But if we think of this page table generally, well, how many virtual page numbers do I have here? I have 2 to the 20 of them. And that's pretty big. And that's pretty hard to store. And that's not going to be acceptable. So we're going to have to store this page table in a way other than what this table would suggest. And there's two things we're going to do. So one is we're going to keep it in memory, that we're not going to be able to like have this in sort of special registers in the processor or something like that. It's too big. And even if we kept it in memory, it's still really big. So we're going to keep it in a tree format. And to make this still fast, processors use something called a translation look-aside buffer, which is basically just a special cache for page table entries. We're not going to talk much about how that works in this class, because it's sometimes covered in various architecture courses. But that's an important part of making this idea of keeping things in memory and using this tree data structure practical, right? That usually we're not actually doing the full lookup. Usually we're just looking up something in a cache. But the way the full lookup works is we're going to have this tree-like data structure that's kept in memory. And the way we're going to do that for 32-bit x86 is we're going to have a two-level page table. We could have more than two levels. And the first level, rather than giving us the actual location of the data, is going to point to a second-level table. And each of these tables, either the first or second level, is going to be an array of 2 to the 10 page table entries, which is going to be a much more manageable size. It's going to churn out that our page table entries are 4 bytes, so these tables are 4 kilobytes or one page, which is very convenient since it means pretty much everything you need to worry about allocating is one page. And you might ask, well, why does this save space? Because so far it seems like I have more space now. I need an entry for everything in the first level, and I need the same number of entries in all the second level tables. So the way we're going to save space is that typically we're going to have large swaths of virtual addresses that don't work. And rather than making a second level table for them, we're just going to mark something as invalid in the first level, and the processor's going to know if we try to use one of those addresses to just say, sorry, the program tried to use an invalid address to the OS using an exception, in particular using a page fault. So at our first level, we'll have a bunch of table entries. We'll have a physical page number, but it won't be the physical page number where the actual program stuff is. It will be the physical page number of the second level table. And we'll also have some metadata, including this valid bit and some other metadata. So we'll look up the physical page number. The processor will do this. And it will find the next table. So in particular, let's say we're looking up page table entry for virtual page number 100. We're going to say, oh, that's in this range here. I'm going to look up here and look for that. If I'm looking up, say, 900, I'm going to look in the third entry because it matches the range. And I'm going to find out that it's invalid. And so I'm going to just stop there. And the second level table is going to have all the entries for that range pointed to by the first level table. So in this example, I'm saying this is the second level table that's pointed to by this fourth entry, the one with index 3, in the second first level table. So it represents virtual page numbers C00 through FFF. And how did I get those numbers? Well, if I have 2 to the 10 entries per table, that what's going to happen is I'm going to divide up the virtual page number into 2 10-bit parts. I use the first 10-bit part to look up in the first level, the second 10-bit part to look up in the second level, as we'll see on a diagram later. Some questions about this two-level structure? Yes. Question, what does this X mean? So in our example, when we looked at the first level table, those entries were marked as invalid in the first level, so there's no second level table for them. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so that's our two level table. Some notes on names, since some sources use different names. I'm gonna call the first level table, which is the thing that a special register in the processor called the page table base register points to, the first level page table, or sometimes the top level page table, or a term that the Intel manuals use, and therefore XP6 uses in its code, the page directory. And the second level table, I'll call the second level page table, or Intel's term, or the term used in the XP6 code, is page table. They just call top level page directory, second level page table, which is a little confusing. But that's sort of what Intel decided to do, even though that's not the way a lot of other things work. And also, this terminology has maybe worked out poorly for Intel, as the 64-bit Intel systems have a 4 or 5 level page table, which means what do you name the other levels? It gets really kind of bizarre. But in the XV6 code, you'll see page directory for the first level, page table for the second sometimes. So we have this two-level table. We have these 4-byte page table entries stored in memory. We'll look at the format of those later. And we use the first 10 bits to find out the index in that first level table, and the second 10 bits to find out the index in the second level. And then we have 12 bits left over in our 32-bit addresses. Those figure out where we are on the page. That's that last step where we combine the page number with the page offset. Okay, so XV6 needs to commonly do things where it manipulates and looks things up in page tables itself rather than just relying on the processor to do it. So there's some header files it has that are just about this. And in the header file, in fact, it shows you, here's how the page table is divided up. Page table lookup is done. We divide up the address like this. And they have macros, which just do the bit manipulation to extract different parts of the address. So they have these PDX and PTX macro, which extracts the page directory index, or the first level page table index, or the page table index, the second level page table index. And they also have this macro which constructs an address from each of these pieces by just doing bit shifting and manipulation operators. Okay. So we know how two-level page table work. Let's say I have, this is my virtual address, and my base pointer, that's the address of the first level page table, is this number, which is a byte address. So this is physical page number 1, page offset 0. That's what that address means. And my question is, what's the first level page table entry we're going to look up? And what's the second level page table entry we're going to look up? And I tell you that when we look up in the first level, we found out that it's valid and indicates physical page number 1-4 hex for the first level and 1-5 in hex for the second level. Give you a little time. who would like some more time for the first level page table entry? Okay, so someone tell me, where's the first level page table entry? What should I, or what's the first thing I should do to figure that out? Yeah.
It's 0x148c.
So you said 0x148c, and how did you get that? And this is a physical address, yeah.
So I just extracted the first 10 bits.
Okay, so first 10 bits, because we know that's used to look up in the first level.
And it was the same as 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
And because...
It's the same as 1, 2, 3? Okay. So let's talk about that. So let's expand this. This is what this expands to. Okay.
So I'm just shifting those bits to the left by 2.
Okay. And so you multiply by 4 because the page table entries are 4 bytes. Okay. And then...
I just shift the bit 1, 2, 3 to the left by 2.
Okay.
Which we're multiplying by 2 to 2. So we have 2 extra zeros at the end of the bits.
Okay.
And I just translated it into...
Okay, so I think there's one other step we were missing here, which is that we need to remember that the page table starts at address 1000.
Yeah, I was going to add that after I translated
it. Okay, we did the multiply by 4. Okay, so there's one thing that is a common mistake here, which is that you're right that, we need 10 bits, so that's in the first 3 digits, because each digit is 4 bits, but it's only half of one of them. So the first 10 bits, if we think of this in binary, are these bits, the 3 kind of bits chopped off. And if I was going to convert this back to decimal, to hexadecimal, I would get an 8, because I'm just reading out 4 bits at a time, and a 4 and a 0. So rather than this being OX14C, I'm going to use the same logic, but I'm going to have OX48 times 4 plus 100. And if you said that a way we could think about doing this is that I'm just adding 2 zeros at the end. So I could say that that's OX120. So we get 120. The rest of the steps are the same. So the key thing we want to find the index. And remember that 10 bits, sorry, it's not a 10 is not a multiple of 4, so we're going to have to divide up hexadecimal digits. Fortunately, if we're thinking about writing code, we're just going to do this with bit manipulation operations. We're not going to have to deal with hex, actually. But if we're doing problems like this, we have to deal with like centering out things into binary. I need to multiply by 4 to account for, that I have a table where the first entry of the table is at address 0x1000, the next entry of the table is 1004, because each entry is 4 bytes. So to advance by 1, I advance by 4, that's the multiplying by 4, that's how I got the entry. So that the address in the first level is 0x120, assuming I did the multiplication correctly. So how about the second level? Someone start me on the second level? Yeah.
I think you can just grab the 3, 4, 5 because the 3 is sort of the last 2 bits.
Okay. So you're saying, okay, it happens that the next 3 bits are the 3, 4, 5, because the 3 is these, and then we have the 4 and the 5. Yeah. 14, and it's going to be 0x14. So you want to stick 3, 4, 5 on the end of that. So you're forgetting the multiplying by 4 step. So it's going to be 0x14000. This is the beginning of physical page 4. Remember that that's just a page number. It doesn't include the offset part. And it's going to be plus 3, 4, 5 times 4. And I'm not going to do that math because I'd probably get it wrong without a calculator. I will certainly let you have for doing these. So questions on figuring any of that? So note that for the second level page table, I found out where it was from the first level. And that told me where the beginning of the table was, and then I added my index times the size of an entry to figure out where in that table it was. Yes?
So I couldn't find the first step, and then we would just one more time try and we didn't use this number to find the
level. So question, this number here, this 1, 4, I didn't use for the first level, is that your question? Or why did I use this 1, 4 to get 14000? How do I use the PPN here? So this is, in our picture, this was the address here. And this tells us where the next table is. So in this example, our fourth entry, it said here that we had this physical address. And that didn't tell us where the actual data in these VPNs was. It told us where the next table, this table, was. It's how we located the beginning of this table. Does that answer your question? And so that's why I'm adding the zeros onto it, because it's a page number, not an address. So what I got was, I got one of these page numbers, right? So I was like told virtual physical page 5 here, this is where the table is. So I need to convert that to the addresses in that physical page. Does that answer your question? Other follow-up. So we're doing this indirection here. Yeah. At the beginning of the page, then we add our offset. And the offset is just an array lookup. Yes, Becca?
How many zeros to add?
How do I know how many zeros to add? I'm using how the addresses are split up. So I have a page offset, which I know is 12 bits because of the page size. And that's why I'm adding 3 zeros. Does that answer your question? Yes.
Is it always true to say that the size of the page table is equal to the page size?
Is it always true that the size of the page table is equal to the page size? This is not true in general. It is true on the system's in x86's setup. The biggest reason why it can't be true in general is that sometimes our virtual address size will not divide up evenly such that you can do that. Yes? So the question is, the virtual first level page table entry is located at this address, and we read from that address, we got that it contained this address, this number. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
How is the
0x15 used? That's going to be used to actually locate the final address and read the data that presumably this program is interested in at that address. Or the code at that address. Does that answer your question? Yes?
In the 0x14, like, you have that, is it 3
Is it three zeros or four zeros? This should be three zeros to correspond to our 12 bits. I'm sorry that I did not write that clearly. This is 1, 4, 0, 0, 0. So the 3, 4, 5 that we're adding better be, it better fit in those in 12 bits, or else I told you something wrong about how big the tables are. Other questions? Yeah. So the question is, why do we need to find these locations? So I'm telling you, so in this example exercise, I'm telling you what the results of the lookup were, but not how the lookup was done. But to get those numbers, the processor would have to have read from these two physical addresses. Or we would if we were doing the lookup. Other questions? So the first page number is 048. The first part of the page number, of the virtual page number is 048, yes. And the second part is 345. And that's just extracting 10 bits from a 32-bit number. Okay, other questions? Okay, so let's do a different exercise here. So let's say I have a page table with exactly this two-level page table structure. How much space do I need to have a process which has one page it can access without any page, without any exceptions happening? Someone? Anyone want to volunteer? Yes.
Two pages.
Two? So how did you get two?
You have your first level page table, and there's only one second level page table containing the one valid entry.
Yeah, so we have a first level pointing to a second level pointing to the one valid entry. We can't get lower than that. Yes, even though you might say, oh, but there's only one valid thing. Sorry, we need to have that first and second every time for a lookup to work. How about if we have every single page accessible without exceptions? How big should that be? Yep.
Isn't it 4k times 2 to the 10?
So you said 4k times 2 to the 10. How did you get that?
And plus 1.
Plus 1? So like this?
Yes.
Okay, how did you get that?
So 4k times plus 2 to the 10 is because we have 2 to the 10 different virtual page number mapping to the second level page table.
So you're saying after the first level, we can have 2 to the 10 different second levels. Okay.
Yeah.
And what's the plus 1 for?
It's for the first level page table.
For the first level, okay. So just a little 2 to the 10 plus, quantity 2 to the 10 plus 1. Yeah. So we have 2 to the 10 tables for the second level, one table for the first level, so that's sort of our fully populated table. Questions? Here. Yes. Sorry. Wouldn't the
2 to the 10?
What about the 2 to the 10? Wouldn't it?
How did you know it was 2 to the 10?
How did I know it was 2 to the 10? Because I used 10 bits to look up in the first level. So there's 2 to the 10 possible. Does that answer your question? Okay. Other questions? Yes. Why are we multiplying by 4k? So we have 10 bits in each of these tables. So that's 2 to the 10 times 4 bytes per entry and 2 to the 10 entries. And this ends up being 2 to the 12, which is 4k. And that's true for both the first and second level tables. They both have 4 kilobytes worth of stuff in them, given the size of each entry. Does that answer your question?
So when you say how big is the text size, are you asking for the amount of bytes?
I'm asking for, yeah, the size. The size we need to reserve in memory. In physical memory. Other questions? Yeah. Why is the first one 2? We have a first level table. Oh, sorry, I wrote 2 page tables, which is going to be 2 times 4k bytes. Right, I was not consistent about the units here. So this 2 times 4k bytes, or 2 to the 10 plus 1 pages, or 2 pages. I was not very consistent about that. Sorry about that. So there's different units we can use to measure it in. I should have written down the units. So the first one is 2 pages, or 2 times 4k bytes. Second one is 2 to the 10 plus 1 pages, since each page table is 1 page, or 2 to the 10 plus 1 times 4k bytes. Yes? How did I compute the first one? There's 1 first level table, and 1 second level table, and each of these tables is 4 kilobytes. Other questions? Yes. Sorry? The first one, what about the first? Why are we adding 1 here? That's because the 2 to the 10 counts the second level page tables. But I still need a first level page table to have all the pointers to the second level page table. Does that answer your question? Okay, other questions? Okay, so we've talked sort of generally about how page tables work, which is hopefully review for a lot of you. Right, and I'm sorry I was not consistent about doing bytes versus pages, which, you know, it matters which we answer in. So in XV6 sets of page tables. So we're gonna talk about how that code works, but first we're gonna talk about how the page tables are set up. And when we're running a program, I mentioned earlier that XV6 divides the memory into 2 pieces. We have this green part, which is for the user code, and we have this blue part, which is for the kernel code. This blue part is the same in every process, and it always starts at this address, which is halfway in the middle of the possible virtual addresses. And it's always set up such that the beginning of this maps to physical address 0, that plus 1,000 maps to physical address 1,000, and so on. So it's just a 1-to-1 mapping that's set up. And it's the same in every process. We have this user part, and that's set up based on what memory is allocated for the user program. And typically, it's going to end up that we're going to have 2 virtual addresses for the same physical address, because we're going to choose addresses to put the user stuff in that are already going to be mapped as part of that 1-to-1 mapping in the kernel. And that's normal, and that's something we can do with page tables. There's no check that if you have a pointer in your second level that it's not the same as some other second level page table entry. And this mapping here is what's going to be stored in the page tables. So questions about this memory layout? Yes?
Why can 2 virtual addresses have the same physical?
To figure out what the physical address is for a virtual address, we look up a page table entry based on the virtual page number. There's nothing restricting that 1 page table entry from having the same physical page number as another. There's no conflict, because the processor, all that it cares that it generates a physical address that makes sense. So as long as the program will behave correctly, given that the result of the translation, it's not a problem. Yes?
Does that not overwrite, for example, like one program runs through the type and the other one writes?
So the question is, what happens if one program writes using this virtual address and another one does here? In that case, if the kernel writes using these addresses and the user code reads using these addresses or writes using those addresses, they'll overwrite each other or read what the kernel wrote. That's just normal. So they're really the same thing,
And they'll behave that way as far as reason writes go. That answer your question?
So because you said it's possible to have two virtual addresses mapped to the same physical address, but for two virtual MAC addresses, I would assume they probably want to have them to be different, right?
So the question is, if I have two virtual addresses mapped to the same physical address, don't I want two virtual addresses to be different? So the OS has made the choice that they do not. And that's just how the OS has set things up, and it has to deal with the consequences of that. Yes, back there?
Yeah, I guess my question is, like, why would you want that?
So the question, why would I want that? So the big advantage here is that when in the kernel code we want to do something with a particular physical address, it's really easy with the setup. And when we want to assign addresses to user programs, we don't want to care about what physical addresses we assign. And so this sort of comes out naturally. It's not going to be the case that we're often deliberately going to be accessing something that the user has mapped using the kernel addresses. But we want easy access to particular physical addresses, and we want to assign user code memory at all sorts of physical addresses. So this just sort of happens naturally. Does that answer your question? Question is, user able to interfere with the kernel? No. So as we'll mention later, the page table entries have a way of marking whether they're accessible if we're executing in user mode, and for this entire blue part, that will be turned off. Okay. So we have these two mappings, and I mentioned it gives the kernel code easy access to all memory, easy way to access a particular physical address, and the program code, we're laying out memory the program expects, no matter where that's actually allocated. So if you look at the green part, this is the sort of layout that XV6 has chosen, which is slightly different than what you might be used to. We have a stack, which is below the heap, which can expand upwards towards the beginning of the kernel memory. Below the stack, we have this thing called a guard page, and then we have the data and text, which is code. And the stack in XV6 is one page. You want to do lots of recursion? Well, you're out of luck. So questions about this layout besides the guard page? Yes?
What does guard page do?
I'll have to talk about the guard page next. Besides the guard page questions, yes.
So you said the stack can move up, right? So like that interferes.
Stack can move, doesn't the stack interfere with you? So the stack starts here, and it grows downwards. But unlike our typical setup, it's not above the heap. It's at an address below. Other questions? Yes?
Is this kernel or user?
This is user addresses, and these are virtual addresses. Okay, so about the guard page. The guard page is a page that's after the stack. It's in the direction the stack grows towards. And it's marked deliberately as accessible only in kernel mode. Why is it marked this way? It's so if stack overflow happens, an exception gets triggered. Hopeful. Yeah?
Is this just like a security thing?
The question is this like a security thing? This is more like a bug checking thing. It's to try to make it so when you have a stack overflow, it crashes in a more predictable way. Okay, so next I'm going to talk about the XV6 code for dealing with pages and memory. And XV6 has this convention in the code that for virtual addresses, they use pointers to represent them. And for physical addresses, they use ints or unsigned ints. And commonly, the XV6 code that deals with setting up page tables is going to have to deal with both physical and virtual addresses. And one thing XV6 has is this conversion from physical to virtual addresses based on that one-to-one mapping. So something to note is that this only works for kernel addresses. So we have this virtual to physical function, which just subtracts that constant, which is the beginning of that blue part of memory. So this converts a kernel address to a physical address. If we want to convert a user address, we're going to have to do something very different. because the user addresses aren't assigned in that one-to-one way. But for the kernel addresses, this subtracts and converts it from a void star to an int. And we have the other direction, where we convert a physical address to a kernel address, and also convert from an int to a void star, you taking advantage of this one-to-one mapping. And note that BTP does not do a page table lookup. So it only handles converting kernel addresses. If you want to convert a non-kernel address, we have to do more work, because the non-kernel addresses are assigned in a more dynamic way. So to deal with paging, we also have to deal with page table entries. And page table entries, we're going to represent as 4-byte numbers. And XP6 has some type defs for them, which are just aliases for an unsigned int. It calls the first level page table entries, remember page directory, PDET, page directory entry, and the second level PTET, page table entry. And remember, these are just aliases for unsigned int, they're just 4-byte numbers. You might say, what's stored in these 4-byte numbers? And the layout of these numbers is defined by the processor. Why the processor? Because the processor does the page table lookup when we're running a program. And this is from the Intel manuals, and this shows the format of those numbers. At the top, we have the format of the page table base register. So this is the special register that indicates where the first level page table entry is. And it has the address of what Intel calls the page directory, or the first level page table, and some other information that's not important for us. Then we have first level page table entries, which have three possible formats here. XV6 uses these last two. So we have a valid bit, which is this least significant bit here. And if it's zero, what happens is it's invalid and it's ignored. Everything else but the valid bit is ignored. If it's valid, we have the physical page number talked about earlier, and we have some metadata. Most notably, we have some metadata about whether we can do writes using this page table entry and whether it's accessible in user mode, which we'll talk about a little later. So this is the first level page table. So this is the PPN of the second level. And then we have second level page table entries, which again, we have two formats which work basically the same way, except this is the PPN of the actual data or code, if it's valid. So questions about these formats? Yes? Question, is the page offset included? No. So these addresses here are page numbers. But if we're thinking about the page offset, these are laid out in a very particular way. And this is a deliberate choice by the Intel's design. And that's that the physical page number lines up with where the physical page number bits of a physical address would be. So if we want to convert this valid page table entry to a physical address, we can just zero out all these bits. And if you want to construct a page table entry from the physical address with the page offset of the beginning of a page, we can just OR in these extra bits here, which we'll call flags. So questions about why this trick works? So this is how we're going to construct page table entries, and also how we're going to extract a physical address from a page table entry. We'll just clear out or set those bits at the end. So XV6 has sort of defines constants that they just copied from the manual for these various extra bits. We have the valid bit, which they call present, which is one. We have this writable bit, which is set, means you can do writes using this page table entry. We have this user bit, which if set means user mode code can use the page table entry. If it's not set, then it's kernel only. And there's also some other bits which are not going to matter. And we have these macros here for extracting just the flags, or extracting or zeroing out the flags to get the address as a byte address of the physical page that's being referred to. So if we think of how to use these to actually manipulate page table entries, let's say I have a process and I want to extract by hand a top level page table entry. So what I can do is I can get the struct proc and I can get a pointer to its top level page table, which is in the page dir entry of the struct proc. And then I can get the index, which is with this PDX macro, this is the top 10 bits of the address. And then I just treat that top level page table as an array. And I get that index in the array. And then I can decode that entry. I can determine, is the valid bit set? Is the writable bit set? Is the user accessible bit set? What is the address of the next table this points to? So questions about how this code works? Yes? So question, what's the difference between this PDX and PTX? So PTX would be the second 10 bits, which would be what we use for the second level lookup. This is just doing the first level lookup. So if we wanted to complete the lookup, we would take this address we got here, look something up from there, and then do the same process again with the PTX, the second 10 bits of the address. Does that answer your question? Question, why are we taking an int? It's just an index into our array of page table entries. And that array is this array here, right? Where each line of this table is an array element. Does that answer your question? Other questions? Okay, so this is extracting and decoding a page table entry in the first level. We can also set page table entries by sort of combining an address that's a physical base address and the bits we want to set. Now, this is typically not how we're going to actually manipulate page table entries. So next time we're going to talk about a bunch of functions that XV6 provides as utility functions and how they work for manipulating page tables. We have functions for allocating pages. We have a function for getting a page table entry in the second level. So this does that first level lookup and the next level of the lookup and gets a pointer to a page table entry. And this is the primary way we manipulate page table entries. Using that function, we can implement functions that do things like set page table entries, a range of them to point to new memory. We can write code which does the setup of page tables to set that one-to-one mapping or to allocate memory for user code or to deallocate memory. And that's what we'll talk about. We'll talk about walk page dir, which is just going to be basically this process done twice next time.